The Thinking Behind It All with Melusine Knives.
The Thinking Behind It All.
Welcome to the second edition of The Thinking Behind It All, our weekly podcast in which we look at the week that was, we look at news stories that trended in the past week. And we must just give a shout out to all the people that have followed us with our first podcast, the comments. It was really good to hear some feedback from them. Actually, there were some questions that I feel we perhaps need to quickly address because, you know, people were concerned about a couple of things. We're not going to address all of them. Be that as it may, it is the second show. We have some new people amongst us. We've got Ricardo from New York City in the United States of America. And from Birmingham, we've got Pauline, and they'll be joining in discussion. And then we've got Isaac, the man who did a brilliant presentation last week about the Winnie situation. I think some of the feedback that we got, that people really enjoyed it. And then we've got Ayana. Follow us on our Facebook page, The Thinking Behind It All. The Thinking Behind It All. Go on Facebook, like the page, comment, tell us about our podcast, the stories that we cover, what your thoughts are, where do you agree with us, do you disagree? And you can also follow the conversations on at @TTBIA_. That's on Twitter, at @TTBIA_. So one of the questions that I received, the query, was the fact that the podcast, The Thinking Behind It All, is a pro-black podcast and it looks at issues from that lens. Does it mean that we are anti-white? And I just wanted to get a couple of comments before we go to our first story about that. Ice, what are your thoughts?
Are we pro-black? Yes, but I think we can find meaning in being pro-black without being anti-white.
It
doesn't necessarily mean because we're pro-black, we're anti-white.
I can't get down with that, man. I'm anti-white. White people are unwilling to accept their privilege. They're unwilling to accept their influence in this world, and they continuously make it so black folks as a collective cannot move forward. And I am definitely anti-white, so I can't get down with the pro-black, we are the world type of sentiment.
No, I don't think that's the sentiment I was going with. I was just saying, I don't see why I'd define myself as like anti-white.
Because white people are anti-you.
I don't think so. Are you saying that we're not included in the white conversation, or?
White people are anti you. They don't respect you. They don't value you. You are simply collateral.
Ricardo, your thoughts?
I, as a rule, try to avoid speaking in absolutes when it comes to populations as big as white people and black people. So when Ayana says white people are anti-me, I mean, is that all white people? Because I don't know. I have known white people who have treated me no differently and have you know, taken my sticking up for me and put their careers, or not necessarily their lives, but definitely their careers and their reputations on the line on my behalf, for my
guys,
blackness.
This is about institutional racism and systemic racism, though. This is not like personal vendettas against white people. These things are systemic. Like, y'all, come on now.
Are there no white people who recognize their privilege and are trying to buck systemic racism?
That's not the point, though. It is of no use to you to say, I am not anti-white, even if you aren't. It is no use for you to make that known. It makes you vulnerable.
Why is it necessary to say that you are anti-white?
Just to make it known that I don't fuck with white people. That's why.
Pudding, what are your thoughts?
I understand institutionalized racism. I get that. But in the main, I know that there are a lot of white people that I know who recognize that they are privileged. They do fight for me. We will always have a fight against institutionalized racism, but we cannot turn around and say that we are anti-white. You know what? One hand washes the other.
In having a podcast like ours, do we say then, based on what Ayana's saying, because I guess it would be directed to her, are you saying then that white people are not supposed to be listening to this conversation?
No, I didn't say that. That's not what I said.
But if you tell white people that you are anti them, then you're really closing off the opportunity of having a discussion with them.
I really could care less whether they tune in or not, because my only mission here is to inspire and motivate my people. That I'm really not interested. Why? Well, first of all, they owe us reparations. So if they really care about making a difference, they will listen and learn. The only white people that I can really rock with are the ones who don't get offended by the truth, because they know what it really is. I am not going to sit here and coddle white folks' feelings when we literally die at their hands.
Ricardo, I want to know from you, do you understand a podcast like this to be a podcast that nurses white people's feelings, or do you see it as a conversation that first of all says this is how black people view news events, and in so saying, if you white person are down with that, then by all means participate in the conversation. I don't see how being pro-black makes one anti-white.
Being pro-black does not automatically make you anti-white. You are correct.
Ayana kind of just said what my thoughts. So I look at it as, is this podcast anti-white? No. But like Ayana has shown, that doesn't mean that we all march in lockstep in every thought, right? So we can all be pro-black on this podcast, which I think we are. But like Ayana has showed, we're not all just automatons where we're just one brain and we all think alike and it all means the same thing to us, which is true with any movement. No, I mean, I can't think of any meaningful movement where everybody just moves in lockstep. And I think this is no different. People shouldn't look at the podcast and then attribute what the podcast is to any one individual here, because it's a collection of people who have like-minded values, but yet we do differ sometimes greatly in certain issues, and that is, I think, what will make this podcast really great moving forward.
It's about a divergence of views where we can have robust engagements as we currently are. And then Isaac, your final remark.
We also have to look at the world that we're living in as well. I don't think I could have a conversation about land reparation in South Africa without including white people, because those are the owners of land right now. I was a bit confused when Ayana said they owe us in terms of reparations, but we can't be having those conversations amongst ourselves as black people only and thinking that we just talking would effect change.
Pauline, your final remarks?
Well, I agree with everybody, because although we have the pro-black, we all have the idea that at some point you do have to engage with white people to achieve certain things. That's me. I don't know what else to say.
Okay. Are we anti-men?
No! I'm not anti-men!
No. There was another query that came up. Are we anti-men?
No! If I say that I'm anti-men, what? That means I'm going against nature. That can't be. That's like saying, oh, I'm anti-food. I need food to survive. I need my men. I need my men to be strong. I need my men to be politicians. I need my men to be fathers. I need my men to be sons. I need my men to be farmers. Everything in life. So there's no way I can ever be anti-men. Never.
Okay, Ayana?
I am a womanist and a misandrist. Patriarchy and misogyny are currently harming and killing people like me, women, and people who are not cisgender men. So men hate me, I hate men. That's that simple. You understand how patriarchy works, right, Moosey?
No, yeah, I don't understand how patriarchy
works. Oh, right, and you understand white patriarchy, you understand misogyny. These things are institutional. It's like, systemic. This is not a personal attack. We have to start addressing institutions in power. We have to start speaking out against them, and it can't always be nice.
Okay, but you can't always separate the individual from the institution.
Absolutely. And so, if they have to feel attacked in order to change, then so be it.
Ricardo?
Do people who feel attacked usually change? Because it's been my experience that not all, but probably the majority of people who feel attacked usually just keep on in the same vein because I'm now being attacked. I'll give an example. So obviously I'm a man. And if a person walks up to me and says, I hate women, I can't front. I look at them crazy. I'm like, why do you feel I hate women? Just because I happen to have been born with a penis and testicles. I can still see my privilege as a man, because if you don't see your privilege and where you have advantages in society and you admit to those and you try to nullify and negate those when you can, how can you still be thrown in a group as a woman hater?
I wanted to ask Ayana a question. Men hate her and yeah, vice versa, right? Is this all men? And also, your idea of patriarchy, is it like white patriarchy? Are you assuming that black people didn't have patriarchy before?
White or not, patriarchy still exists. Even if it weren't for white supremacy, there would still be patriarchy. There would still be female genital mutilation going on, even in Africa. We can't blame it all on white patriarchy, men or men.
But I'm sure you could distinguish between a Victorian gentleman and an African man.
Yes, well, one of the leading causes of death of black women is intimate partner violence, and most black women are in romantic and domestic relationships with black men.
But then, don't you think, Ayana, that women need to get away from this romantic idea of both men and women get away from this romantic idea of what real relationships are when there is violence within a relationship? Obviously, a lot of it is learned behavior. I don't believe that you hate. Hate is a very, very strong word. I believe that dislike, and more that you have and other people have certain views, and maybe it's a certain attitude towards things.
Ayana, do you have anything in response to say?
All of my wording is always intentional, and it's always an act of resistance against power. So I use these words intentionally, not because I'm speaking out of emotion, but I'm speaking out of intention to make a point. Men are socialized to be violent.
not just in romantic relationships are women being abused by men. Gay women get abused by men. Yeah. Where family members of men get abused by men. So, you know.
And women abuse too. Women abuse too.
I understand, but it's just not at the same rate.
Proportionally, it's more men that abuse, I would say, proportionally speaking. Last week, we covered the passing of Ma Winnie, and this weekend, it's a funeral. In the last week alone, there have been several memorials, several articles, in which we just saw a lot of political posturing and people positioning themselves as persons of the people. Essentially, taking that role of what Ma Winnie was in South Africa. Of course, we're not going to forget the fact that at least for the last, 20, 30 years, she was vilified, as we've come to learn from the whole Stratcom agenda in which they sought to discredit her by all means. This week, we've had the president of South Africa making statements such as Ma Winnie would have not stood for corruption, and
she always said, Tumamina, and she always went.
Then we had several, what some would say, political rallies in which it played out as if different factions, both on a societal level but also on a political level. For example, one of the big memorials we had was done by the national government, but on the same day we had one of the opposition parties, the Economic Freedom Fighters, having their own memorials in Free State. The fact that it was screened on national TV for the first time this week, that there was an actual campaign to discredit Winnie. The Stratcom, I would encourage you to go listen to our previous podcast in which Isaac touched upon how organized the previous regime was in discrediting Ma Winnie.
In the years, I really got terribly disillusioned with the media, because some of them were actually used by the state, the then apartheid state. I mean, there were reporters who specialized in writing very negative stories about me, like Thandi Kobule, a girl who was called Noma Venda. Have you come across any of those names?
No.
When you were digging,
they
were working for what was then called the Weekly Mail.
Yeah,
I was pleasantly surprised to see Anton Harbour talk like that, because he was editor of the then Weekly Mail, and the Weekly Mail at the time was so anti-ANC, anti-me. They actually did the job for Stratcom.
This led to a discussion on Twitter, especially Black Twitter in South Africa, in where people were talking about it's most unfortunate to have seen something like this materialize. It's disgusting. And the fact that it's only coming out now, seeing that Ma Winnie has passed on, and people want to pretend as if, you know, they've always liked her, they've always been for her, and they've always believed in her. Meanwhile, there are 40 plus journalists who are part of this campaign. It has led to an awkward discussion where some members of the media are remaining stum on talking about the journalists that are actually party to this whole smear campaign. Black Twitter is feeling that the media needs to be held accountable. These journalists need to come out and account for what they've done. So I'm going to start with Isaac.
In terms of the events that were held, what the media goes with is this idea that she's the mother of the nation and she belongs to everyone. Everyone should be allowed to celebrate her, right? But people that tried to send condolences, like Desmond Tutu, who was the head of the TRC,
The Truth Reconciliation Commission.
Commission, yeah. It was a farce, man. Because of how it was run, especially by Desmond Tutu. When Winnie came, he sort of targeted her, forced her to make an apology.
I speak to you as someone who loves you very deeply. I would have said to you, let us have a public meeting. Another public meeting for you to stand up and say, there are things that went wrong. And I don't know why they went wrong. And say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for my part in what went wrong.
I was seething with rage. To this day, I ask God to forgive me for not forgiving him. He was acting there for the public, acting there for Stratcom, begging me to say I was sorry.
I beg you.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say sorry as if I had been responsible for apartheid.
Black Twitter was like, yo, man, save us with your condolences, because you were the person that, like, were instrumental in persecuting her and branding her this villain.
Paulina, I just want to know from you, being based in the UK, there was an interview here in South Africa by a talk radio station called 702, in which one of the security officers responsible for the smear campaign was interviewed. In the interview, his name is Paul Erasmus.
I've been saying this, shouting off the rooftops ever since the TRC, and even prior to that. Nobody really took notice. I was discredited from both the left and right wing. Like I say, I was called a traitor by my own people, the Afrikaners, which was not a measure of the truth. My motivation from the start was that my former bosses saw me as a traitor when I just couldn't handle this type of filth that was going on anymore, and I took a transfer to Mossel Bay, walked into a hornet's nest here where the official monitoring system was being used to bug, yes, Petrosa, Mosgas. And when I took exception to this, I became a target, and was then told at one point that my colleague from the border, Eugene de Kock, was going on his way to kill me and my children, Candace and Dylan, my children, and my ex-wife, Linda, and that the Nats were going to use this as a propaganda thing to get back at the ANC. Stressed ex-cop living in Harold's Bay gets blown to bits with a limpet mine. So I turned against these people. I mean, who can forgive something like that? I gave the best years of my life, got medals and all sorts of bloody stuff from them. And let me tell you something, they were a bunch of scheming murderers. Winnie did not kill Stompie or any of those other children. In fact, Winnie took them and gave them refuge because they were being sexually abused at the manse, which wasn't too far from her home. And this was going on an ongoing basis. The person responsible there was Paul Verein of the Methodist Church.
Paul admitted to being the one who was charged with the responsibility of actually discrediting Winnie and making all these false claims in terms of her killing Stompy.
I think it's politics, and I'm just sad that he'd left it so long, to my knowledge, to talk the truth. I'm just totally sad about the whole event, but as I said, it's politics, and in politics, people always try to discredit the opposition. It's even sadder that this child's name is synonymous around Winnie Mandela, and how they try to portray her as this hard woman with no feelings and such forth. It's all adigenic. Or when a person dies, they're the best person that ever lived. They did this, and they're recognized for all the good they did. But she should have been recognized while she was alive.
Well, I mean, we just have to consider that not so long ago, hardly 15 years ago, she was still being trialed and she was convicted of being corrupt, stealing £80,000. Just makes one wonder, were those charges also fabricated? Ricardo, what are your thoughts?
Winnie Mandela had two huge strikes against her, which you could pretty much count as three. One, she was a woman. Two, she was a woman married to a very influential, powerful man, and she happens to be black as well, right? Just look at, in the United States, Dr. Martin Luther King, his assassination, the anniversary of his assassination was a couple weeks ago, right? This guy, no joke, he was voted the most hated man in America in the 60s, right? Now, man, you would believe that every politician who was old enough marched in Selma with the guy, right? Like, I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, some of you guys must have hated him back then, too. You know, so what changes the tune? The social climate has changed. The political climate has changed where they needed a figurehead to love. Basically, he's become the token Negro for unity. But I just wanted to point out parallels on how specifically women and people of color are always used as political pawns
yeah.
when it comes to white politicians making hay for their own agenda.
And speaking of this whole agenda, as this week we were commemorating the day in which Chris Hani was assassinated, we saw the Democratic Alliance, which is the official opposition in South Africa, they came out saying long live the spirit of Chris Hani and that he was a hero. And basically they were speaking as if he was the nicest person ever. This is a man that is pro-black people getting the land, right? So expropriation without compensation is certainly a principle that he would agree with. And more importantly, in terms of the Democratic Alliance, they are opposed to that. We see it now with the current political climate. So does this also speak to the same thing that we're seeing unfolding with Mawini?
I think we as a black nation also need to do more as to protect what our leaders have stood for. I also didn't like the way Chris Hani was being appropriated by liberals, where else he's on the opposite end in terms of how he thinks of the economy, in terms of how he thinks of how our country should have been shaped. When he saw that some of our leaders might be trying to sell us out, he'd speak against that.
Ayana, in terms of the journalists, do you think that in times like these, when all of a sudden everybody is jumping on the bandwagon and saying how great a leader is, seeing that the leader has passed, Mawini being one of them now, do you think journalists actually have a responsibility to account for their actions as well?
Yeah, they do have an obligation to integrity, right? Do they have the liberty to report how they want to, seeing as how they work for these media houses?
Pauline, what are your thoughts in terms of journalist obligation? I mean, if journalists always want to tell the public that they are about honesty and integrity, and a situation like this unfolds, we find out that there were plus 40 journalists who were involved in a smear campaign, and all of a sudden those journalists, we don't know who they are, media houses are not taking responsibility, it's squarely placed on the politicians. Well, what does it mean for us?
You've got more journalists that are working freelance, whether they know their story to be right or true, they're quick to sell it to the highest bidder. And I do find those who work independent on their own, they will always have the truth, but at the same time, sometimes they can be quietened into what they discover about what is the truth.
Ricky, what are your thoughts? Here you have people on the hustle, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's a capitalist system. Media is run by big corporates. They set the agenda. How do we balance that? And how do we hold the media accountable? Especially here in South Africa, there's this undertone that the media must self-regulate. The media must self-govern. The media can only be accountable to its own. And they then define what honesty is, what transparency is, what accountability is.
I think the facts are always going to be the facts, but people will always find multiple truths. And this is the perfect example of that. So you have people who will take a fact, or what is perceived to be a fact, but yet they'll shape the truth in such a way to mislead and misguide people. And I think that is the true evil of mass media as we have it today. Matter of fact, I shouldn't even say today, because it was actually worse before social media. Now people at least could be checked.
Facebook and Alex Stamos, its chief information security officer, are parting ways. The departure comes on the same day that Facebook said that it's investigating whether it allowed a data company called Cambridge Analytica to access and allegedly keep data profiles of 50 million users. Former Trump advisor Steve Bannon sat on Cambridge Analytica's board, and the Trump campaign ended up paying the company nearly $6 million. But before CA could land that contract, it had to show that its voter profiling model worked on a mass scale. And to do that, it needed an epic bundle of data. Vice News spoke to the whistleblower who made it all happen.
My name is Christopher Wiley. I'm a data scientist, and I helped set up Cambridge Analytica. When Steve Bannon wanted to build an arsenal of weapons for his culture war, he liked the idea of working with a company that has lots of military clients. Fundamentally, what Cambridge Analytica was the transposition of military-style information operations and propaganda to an American political consultancy so that it can create a web of disinformation on Facebook and other platforms.
Facebook is involved in a data breaching scandal with Cambridge Analytica. We've come to find out that Facebook has been providing our personal data to Cambridge, and they have been using it to influence elections in America and the UK, even in Nigeria. And Americans are quite upset at the fact that their data has been used in a way that they don't believe they authorized. People are, for some reason, surprised that their data has been being used. I don't know why, but they need someone to blame. So I guess they're like, blame Cambridge.
Ricardo, we saw Mark Zuckerberg appearing in the congressional hearings, being questioned about the privacy aspect. What stood out for me was the fact that Americans were grappling with the question of Facebook being a monopoly of some sort and pushing profit margins rather than securing private information of users. Is America going soft on capitalism? What's happening?
Oh, never that. And me being a greedy capitalist, I totally stand by this statement. No, we're not going soft on getting money. But here's the thing. What you heard was not the average American's opinion on this. What you heard was a congressman grandstanding and fomenting false outrage. Okay? People are mad because they weren't in on, they didn't get a cut. They sold their information for free. I bet you if they said, hey, we'll give you $1 for every time Cambridge Analytica uses your content, people would have signed up of it. That's why we're mad. We didn't get a cut. Here we are. People have been using Facebook the last, 10 years, basically? And they thought there wasn't a price to pay? The price happens to be their privacy. I don't know why people are surprised now.
Look, we've been using Facebook for free all this time. And how do you think they've been making their money? Advertisements. So they've been using our data, and we knew that.
It's because it wasn't transparent to a lot of people. What if it's stated in your whatever they called it from the beginning? You know, Apple told you from the beginning, all your information is safe.
But in all honesty, like, not too many people read the user agreement, the terms and conditions when they use it.
But you know what? Compared to the amount of millions of people that are on there, there's a good few that do.
Isaac, part of the scandal in relation to Cambridge Analytica is that they influenced elections, not only in Africa, Nigeria, and Kenya, but most importantly, to Americans' dismay, the fact that they influenced the 2016 elections, which led to President Trump being in the White House. They're upset that Russia got involved. Do you think this is actually the core?
In terms of like Facebook, what they're in business of is information. Your photos are never deleted on their main servers. I think Facebook is actually used by the American government. I don't know, it's a conspiracy theory, Nam, but...
It's not much a conspiracy theory anymore, is it?
No, definitely not.
Is it such a bad thing to think of social media platforms being used to influence elections? Should we really be concerned to a point where we have in congressional hearings about it?
I don't think so. You're trying to brand yourself. That's why we have pages. People are political on Facebook. They're trying to express their own realities as well, their strife. I don't see it.
Ricardo, what do you think?
I don't think it's inherently bad, but like any tool, it can be used to do bad things. And that's how I think of Facebook. So let's pretend that there wasn't a Russian component to this, right? Would people still be as upset? I don't know. I think that's where a lot of a certain segment of America is outrageous. Oh, those Russians, they bamboozled us. You know, they pulled the wool over our eyes and this, that, and the third. And nobody likes the idea of being made a fool of or being led by the nose.
Especially Americans.
I guess so.
We're looking at the Democratic Alliance. Democratic Alliance is the official opposition to the ANC. They are from a Congress right now where they were selecting new leadership, given that next year we're going to the polls. The issue with their Congress, unlike the ANC's Congress that preaches unity amongst its members, is that it left members more divided in terms of the direction, mainly because they want to represent the majority of Black South Africans, but they've elected mostly a white executive. Their top eight only has two Black members. The issue here is that there are factions within the DA. They're all under the guise of liberalism, but there's these new woke kids that are joining the DA for financial gain. There's the older generation who are still conservative in their approach of liberalism. The issue here is that the DA is not speaking in a common language. We see dissent in leaders in the Gauteng branches. Solim Simang said that the DA needs to mold their rhetoric so as to accommodate more ideals. Black members of the DA felt they weren't represented in terms of the views that were being spoken in Parliament.
Ayana, the DA elected essentially eight people into the executive structure. The majority of them, seven of them, are males, and one is a female. Furthermore, six of them are white and two of them are Black. Do you think such a party is clearly aligned with the sociopolitics of a country that has a history such as South Africa?
This seems like they have the tokens there. That's about it.
Ricky, do you have anything to add?
My question is, what are their economic and like cultural leanings and, you know, family structure, things of that nature? Like, what makes them liberal?
They are people that are pro-white in many ways, but they will say that they are pro-South African, okay? That's the first thing. But it's an easy argument to make. Why? It's because you live in a country where English is a standard language in business, it's the currency in education, and pretty much in government as well. If you're a traditional African, that is, you are backward. You know, you're not progressive. You need to be the sophisticated Black person living in urban centers to be able to really grasp what it means to be liberated. Cultural activities, traditions, those are ridiculed. People are made to feel inferior who are in this position. I mean, you look at Jacob Zuma's rise to power. Jacob Zuma was a president that used to enjoy singing. He sings, he dances. Why? Because it's part of his makeup as a Zulu man. But it was something that was attacked a lot in his early days of his presidency and prior to him becoming a president. These are the kind of dynamics that people are grappling with when they talk about liberalism and what it means. Being liberal, you are more inclined to say what Eurocentric is right and what is leaning towards Asia or what is African is not really that cool.
Gotcha. So, coon more, talk less. Got it.
Yeah.
That's it. Pauline, what are your thoughts?
I just think that you should have people that genuinely represent the masses. And I'm sorry, six whites, I don't care how liberal they are, does not represent South Africa.
That brings us to the end of the show. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for your support. Remember that you can follow us on our Facebook page, The Thinking Behind It All, or you can go to Twitter. Our handle there is at @TTBIA_. Give us commentary, ask us questions, tell us where we can improve. Tell us how much you love us. Thank you for the team. Thank you to my man Ricardo Mahambane from the United States of America, New York. Thank you to my girl Ayana. Thank you to Usis Pauline from Birmingham, the United Kingdom. And thank you to ISE. Till we meet again.